Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Well, we've all been horrified by the images coming from Ukraine over the past 2 months, and we've been speaking to reporters on the ground over the course of the conflict, and one of those who has kept us up to date is Belle True, international correspondent with the London Independent. Well, Belle has left Ukraine in order to have some time out before potentially returning next month, and Belle is on the line now. Belle, hello, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too.
It's nice to talk to you when you can actually take a breath and I don't feel that you're in danger or any sort of danger while we're talking. How are you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to be able to take a break because it is very, very intense in Ukraine, not only just if you're near the front lines, but even if you're thousands of kilometres away because of the threat from the sky, which is, of course, what a lot of the Ukrainian civilians are complaining about.
Mm-hmm. You have lots of experience working in war zones, but you describe this as one of the worst or among the worst conflicts that you've covered. Why do you say that?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I've been covering conflict now for about 12 years, mostly based in the Middle East. So Syria, Yemen, Libya, Sudan, you know, some of the worst types of conflicts of our time in Iraq, for example, against ISIS. And I would say it is up there as among the worst that I've experienced. I think, first of all, because of the level of weaponry. We're talking about a nuclear power. We're talking about two armies that are incredibly well, you know, they have quite serious weaponry. But from the, you know, Russian side, as I said, it's a nuclear power. They have these immense cruise missiles that they can use. So, as I said, you could be 1,000 kilometers away from the front line, but be under fire from the sky. They also aren't afraid to use weaponry that's banned in many countries in the world, like, for example, cluster munitions, which are completely indiscriminate and basically designed to maim civilians, or white phosphorus that can literally burn through your flesh and through your bone. So in one way, there is this sort of advanced weaponry that's absolutely terrifying. But second of all, as we've seen over the last few weeks, since the Russian forces have left those areas, that the level of war crimes that have been committed, or potential war crimes that have been committed, is really high and widespread. So I was in areas that were just outside of Kyiv, but also several hundred kilometers away in areas like Sumy, which is near the border with Russia, to the east, where I was coming across civilians who were telling me that they had been subjected to mock executions, or they'd been tortured, or their family members had been executed, or their family members had been disappeared. I stumbled upon torture chambers, reports of women who'd been raped, you know, as I said, forcible transfer of civilians to Russia, just layer upon layer of misery, of violence, of this sort of nightmarish world that makes this conflict so nasty.
And you were in Zaporizhia too, and that's the town where people who managed to get out of Mariupol, that's the first stop for them, and you were meeting the families who had escaped that place.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely extraordinary, because Mariupol has been, we don't know what has happened there, because of course the international media hasn't had access, or Ukrainian media hasn't had access to this town that's been under siege since pretty much the start of the war, and under some of the most heavy bombardments. As we know, it's still going on to today. But while I spoke to some families, and the sort of situation they described was truly horrendous. People had been living for weeks underground, eking out the small amounts of food supplies they had, risking their lives to come up to the surface just to cook. People had been killed trying to get out, because all the areas out of the city were under heavy shelling or under missile strikes. There was also, you know, horrendous stories about the disabled, the sick, the infirm, who weren't able to get to their basements, literally burning alive in their beds. Families had been split up. I met one woman whose husband, you know, she had gone back to their family home to try and protect it from looting, and she hadn't heard from him in about a month because the phone lines are down. The last time she spoke to him, she said that he was crying for the first time she'd ever heard him cry. He was in tears, just saying, "I don't care about my flat or the possessions anymore. I just want to get out of here." And she doesn't know if he's alive. And so there's this, I mean, really the sort of stuff of your worst nightmares taking place in this town. And we don't know what's happened there yet.
And on the other side then, you've been speaking to, or at least you've been dealing with, Russian military personnel. I mean, what's your take on who those people are, what they're like, what sort of organisation is there on that side of things?
So there seems to be, you know, quite a big mix. We've got the mix between the sort of Russian army proper. We've got different groups like Chechen forces. You've got a lot of conscripts, so a lot of very young, inexperienced soldiers. We've also had reports, which I haven't fully been able to confirm, but I'm working on, of mercenaries from different places, including possibly Syria. So we're talking about a big hodgepodge. of different people in this army. Some of them extremely well trained with very heavy weaponry. Some of them, like conscripts, really a bit lost and very young, clearly almost used as cannon fodder. But really, speaking to different Ukrainian civilians who've had to obviously live under the occupation of these forces, the resounding strange message that I got from them was that there was actually a large portion of them who were drunk all the time. And I know that sounds somewhat ridiculous, but it's also quite terrifying if you're a civilian population, you know, being occupied by forces. But definitely when I went into the trenches that had been vacated by Russian forces or buildings that had been used as headquarters, there's just scattered with empty bottles of vodka. In one room, there was a half-drunk bottle of Prosecco. I spoke to one doctor who said that a drunk colonel stumbled into his clinic late at night trying to find medical alcohol to drink. So I get the sense that there is a disorganization. They obviously thought this was only going to take 48 hours. Whole sections of the army got cut off from other sections because of poor supply lines. They lost a lot of armored vehicles, at least according to experts, because they hadn't sort of exercised those vehicles for a long time. So there was a lot of tires breaking down, which meant they lost a lot of their armored vehicles and their trucks, which of course, as I said, impacted their supply lines. So I think although they are, you know, obviously a very well-equipped, well-trained army, there was a sense that they maybe had bitten off more than they could chew, that there was a disorganization. There's also a ferocious attack on the civilian population in these areas in terms of summary executions, literal torture chambers that they set up. And also, as I said, this erratic behavior of quite a lot of drunk troops in a war zone.
And Belle, just going back to your own personal take on the experience of this, and again, I know that you're experienced and you've been in war zones before, but did this feel more dangerous to you?
I think in many areas it did. So around Kyiv, for example, there was a sense that journalists were being targeted quite specifically. So we obviously saw that horrendous footage from the Sky News team who came under an ambush, which is literally the stuff of nightmares for journalists. We also had a photographer that was killed on the outskirts of Kyiv in Irpin. And of course, we had the Fox News team who came under fire from shelling. We have several Ukrainian journalists who have been killed. So on one hand, there's a sense that they will go there, that journalists are not seen as non-combatants who are supposed to be protected under various different points of international law and are basically civilians. We were the targets. At the same time, as I said, you know, because of the sophistication of the Russian armory, basically, because of their weapons, you are not safe anywhere. So you could be sitting 1,000 kilometers away from the front line in a city like Zhytomyr, and suddenly, you know, a cruise missile comes out of the sky and takes out the school in front of you, which nearly happened to me, actually. We happened to get to the site sort of 15 minutes afterwards, but essentially, you know, that was very, very far from the front line. And, you know, the cruise missile was able to take it out, you know, from a very far distance away. So there is a sense that the front line is, it's not, it's a moving thing, and that you're under risk wherever you are in the country. And there's also a sense from the Russian forces that they will go there. They will use banned weaponry. They don't care. They've done this in Syria. And so you're not thinking about this in terms of an armed force that's respecting international law.
So, Belle, you come out of there and you have some time off and try and rest and recover. How do you do that? You know, given what you've seen, what you've witnessed, what do you do in your downtime now to try and prepare yourself perhaps for going back?
It's actually really hard. And I think in terms of the media, they're really starting to come to terms with a sense of PTSD and how journalists respond to that and how we do that downtime and how we look after each other. I mean, certainly I would probably say that I haven't properly had a full night's sleep since I left, because it's very hard to switch your brain off. And obviously you hear different sounds and it reminds you of the sounds of fighter jets or strikes or shelling or whatever it is. But I think for me, the most important thing is just to try and switch your brain off, because, and that's a really hard thing to do because you feel guilty. You know, our Ukrainian colleagues are Ukrainian, you know, fixers, drivers, journalists. They cannot leave Ukraine, and that is their livelihood and their homes and their families. And so you feel this immense sense of guilt, because you can just leave, get on a plane, sit on a beach if you want to, go home, hug your loved ones. And that isn't what they are able to do. So you have to sort of manage the sense that you've got to recharge, because you need to go back, and it's really important to tell this story. Mm-hmm. It's really important that the world's news focus remains on Ukraine. But at the same time, you know, you have to manage that guilt of the fact that we can go, we can leave, we can rest up, and we make a choice to go back in. That is not the case for Ukrainian civilians, Ukrainian journalists, and all the Ukrainian staff that are working with different international news teams.
Do you want to go back?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm hoping to go back in June. It's so important. I just realized this, you know, I was in Trostianets, as I said, which is just near the Russian border. And I just stumbled upon these civilians who've been held for 10 days and tortured in an underground torture chamber. And that was the case every single house that I went to in these areas. You talk to a civilian and there'd be the most horrendous story. You are uncovering in real time war crimes. And that evidence is really important because I believe there will be war crime trials in the future. And I think it's a responsibility of journalists and human rights defenders and investigators to collect that evidence and present it, because we need to have some accountability, some justice for these people. So for me, not being there, not being part of that sort of movement to uncover crimes, to speak the truth, would be devastating. So yes, I'm hoping in June to go back.
Well, Belle, I hope you get a rest, some real R&R over the next couple of weeks. And I know that if and when you go back in June, we'll certainly speak to you from Ukraine. That's Belle True from the London Independent. We'll have more on the Northern Ireland Assembly elections after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.